Parkcast, the UK's original theme park podcast.
Welcome back to Parkcast Park Fans. We're a podcast for theme park fans. We're here every week. We chat about things going on in the theme park industry. We look at news, we look at new developments, and sometimes we have some interesting guests on with us as well. I'm Vex, and I'm usually with Kev. He's not available this week, but I do have a guest with me. Delighted to be joined by Benedict Chicora, who is a project manager by trade and who's worked in the attractions industry for many, many years. We'll go through some of that as we have this chat, but I think it's going to be an interesting chat to give us a bit of insider info onto how things happen in theme parks and how these things that kind of emerge from plans actually end up being reality. Benedict, welcome to Parkcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure talking to you, and I have to say, your intro might make me sound very, very old, because I've been working many years in the industry. But now, the reality is, like, I am older these days, so I get that. No, it's funny, but yeah, no, it's about 20 years now. So I just was thinking about it today, and yeah, by the 1st of January next year, it will be 20 years on the dot. So it is quite a while.
It is a long time. Not too old, though. Not like, you're not ancient.
No,
I'm going to put myself in the same age bracket as you. So.
Same bracket, yes.
And as you can probably tell if you're listening to Benedict, he's not of UK descent. You're obviously originally from Germany, now living in Australia, so, you know, quite well travelled. How does that happen? How do you end up in Australia?
I sometimes ask myself, how does that happen? How did it happen? Well, it happened. I think because I wanted it. So I always had the desire to work abroad and kind of like travel the world. And I think that was the main driver. And I think if you want something really, really badly and look into that, then somehow it works. But no, I had a great opportunity 20 years ago, or 20 and a half year ago, years ago, when Merlin were looking for a project manager. And at the time they were quite small, and their project management department only had two project managers, which were based in Hamburg and Germany. And I was living in Hamburg, and so I'm an architect by trade, and I worked as a site manager for a construction company. And then Merlin published this advert saying they're looking for a project manager, working on international kind of like attraction projects, and that kind of like sparked my interest. Never heard of Merlin before, to be honest. Didn't even hear of Sea Life or anything like that. But then applied, and then I took about 6 months to get on board. But that's how it started. And then I started with an aquarium in Munich in 2006. That Sea Life in Munich opened in 2006. And then from there, I did more aquariums for Merlin, then worked in theme parks for Merlin, worked in North America, worked across Europe on different projects. And then Merlin acquired some attractions in Australia, and I put my hand up and said, well, I'm interested. And then Merlin said, well, that could work. And then we just, you know, took probably 9 months to make it all happen. And for the first 6 months, I was commuting on a monthly basis to Australia and started working on these projects.
It was a long commute.
2 weeks. Yeah, two weeks in Australia, 2 weeks back, and my wife was pregnant with the second child, and we got married in between. So it was a lot happening, and then we moved to Australia, and like many, I don't know if you speak to others who moved to Australia, you kind of like get stuck quite easily in Australia. So it wasn't our plan to move forever. It was really just with Merlin, it was like for 2 years minimum. And after 2.5 years or 3 years, I think everything here was kind of like done. And then I moved back to Germany and then realized quite quickly that we actually liked Australia more. And then, yeah, I applied for permanent residency, moved back, worked again, like in the entertainment industry, worked for a big cinema chain and then did cinemas, And then shortly after, I started my own business, which is almost like 9 years ago, and then ever since worked in the entertainment industry.
Yeah, so that's what you do now. You've got BSK Consulting. So that's kind of you consult to the attraction. Well, not, it's not just the attractions industry. It's like the leisure industry as a whole, isn't it?
Correct. It's I've got two things. One is BSK Projects, which is like a project management company focused on client side project management with a focus on hospitality slash entertainment leisure, and do a lot for still for Merlin. I work for zoos. I work a lot with animals, and then over the last 20 years have worked a lot with animals and predominantly aquariums. And I've also launched a second kind of like business last year, which is called Isaacs, which stands for Independent Zoo and Aquarium Consultancy Services. So just Isaacs, the acronym is quite nice, but the name is quite long, but we like the name, the short form, where we focus on zoos and aquariums and do far more than just project management, and also do animal acquisition and look into animal welfare and the operation and life support system development, all these kind of things. So I'm quite nichey in what I do, but enjoy it.
Yeah, well, it sounds fascinating, and we'll hear about all this in the discussion. And it's interesting, the zoo thing. Zoos are diversifying, and we're starting to see zoos sort of go into putting some major rides in some instances. And obviously, you've spent time working with Merlin, and their theme park division is something that we talk about a lot on here. So we'll cover all this stuff. I just want to go a little bit back to the start with you, because you obviously grew up in Germany, and you mentioned you hadn't really like paid much attention to the themed attraction industry, and Merlin weren't really on your radar. Did you visit theme parks growing up? I mean, you lived in the best country in Europe for visiting theme parks. You must have done.
I kind of did, yeah. So we went to my very first theme park was Phantasialand in Brühl.
Oh, it's a great one to start as your first park, setting a
Yeah,
standard.
but I must have been anything between 6 and 8 or 10 or something. So it's I hardly remember. What I do remember vividly is that they had a dinosaur kind of like exhibit. It might have been a permanent at the time, and they had like dinosaurs figures there, and that's my memory of Phantasialand, really. And that was just, it was just a nice setting, and I just remember going there as a family. It was just nice with my siblings and my mum, and it was just a nice thing to do. But more theme park experience was the Efteling, which was just across
Okay,
the border,
yeah.
and we went there a couple of times, and there's some photos still exist from that time, and that's more like a theme park, because that's kind of like with some rides, and they had this I think the wild water kind of like thing, but it's all, yeah, quite long ago. And to be honest, like I'm not a big fan of things moving very fast, and especially kind of like in circles and turning things. Like I can do with a roller coaster, that's okay, but if I'm something which spins just in a
Yeah.
circle, I just like really struggle. So I'm not the biggest fan of those kind of like things. So
Yeah.
it's funny. So and yeah, I just got into the theme park industry by accident. But I love it, and I would not change it ever. And it was just, I think, the best thing what could have happened to me. And because it's such a diverse field to work in, it's driven by what I love about it is A, it's driven by very passionate people. It's driven by people who've got a passion for what they're doing, which I love, and it's driven by innovation, and it's always something new, and you always kind of reinvent what you're doing, and that makes it interesting, right? You're not dealing with the same thing over and over again. So
Yeah. Yeah, everyone's always looking for the next big thing, what they can do differently, what's going to attract us as theme park enthusiasts, but obviously more importantly, the general public as a whole, what's going to get us talking, what's going to get us excited. And I think that's the reason a lot of us are enthusiasts of the theme park industry, because it is so exciting and it's always changing. And, you know, you mentioned how Fantasyland was when you first went there and what it is now, it would be unrecognizable. I don't know if you've been since things like Fly have been put in and Taran and just you have to go. It's a work of art. It's just you get transported into these worlds which you can't believe that a few hundred meters on the other side of the barrier line is just like roads and houses. Fantasyland is like literally in the middle of a lot of houses.
I think we live in a very exciting time, because it's kind of like there's a lot happening at a very fast pace at the moment. Mm. And theme parks change from just being a roller coaster, which for example was very high or very fast or very steep, to now become a really immersive experience, which starts with like your queuing or lining up experience, and make that kind of like experience already, and then all the audio video kind of like opportunities and possibilities you have these days. It's just like it's just bringing it to the next level at a very fast pace. So and almost like every project at the moment I'm working on is this something new. And there's a lot of research and development, and I find it very exciting at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. We're all excited. We're excited to see what comes next. And you're right. It's not just about having the biggest and tallest anymore. It is about the experience as a whole. I think we as audiences kind of demand that experience. And actually, if you provide that experience, I know that, you know, Mark Shaw, who is on this podcast, you can charge more for that experience if it is a well-rounded quality thing that's been put together for the guests. So.
Correct, and you wanna, and you see that in all the theme parks, and the ones which haven't changed are currently changing. But you want to make it like an experience from when you arrive to when you leave, and you wanna make it a destination, and that's why theme parks at hotels, for example, so people stay, and you've got bigger and better offerings and more, so people just make it like a trip of like two nights or 2 days and a night, and it's great. It's just fantastic with doing that with kids, like, because you just like you've got something new every day and you just keep them entertained for 2-3 days. And then I've got kids, my eldest is 16 and my youngest is 12, but you know, we've got the Gold Coast here in Australia, which got lots of theme parks, and we went there like I think 5 years ago, just before COVID, I think. And it was just like they still talk about it, and we just have to go back. It's an amazing experience.
Yeah, it is. And one, there's not many things that a whole family can enjoy together. And I do think theme parks and attractions, you know, things like you mentioned aquariums, things like that. It is something that you can go all together as a family. And I think that's what makes them quite special. Right. Let's talk about what you do. So project management, it's a very broad term. And I'm sure it's broad for a reason, because it does involve so many different aspects of making something happen. But essentially, if we've got a theme park which say already exists and they have something new that's going in, it could be just a ride or a whole themed area or an attraction, I guess the project manager is like the linchpin who's going to help make all that happen. Is that how you'd kind of sum up what you do?
Yes, I think it is. Like when I explain to people who haven't worked with project managers before, then what I usually say is that I provide kind of like certainty on your project outcome. So I help delivering your vision, and I'm also the one pushing back on your vision when I say it's not realistic with either the time frame you've given me or the budget which is available, right? So it's just like just really helping people to make that vision become a reality, and help them by setting a project up in the right way and looking at like challenges, opportunities, restrictions, looking at it from a planning point of view. Do you need most theme parks got a general planning permit and you fall within, and you've got a very kind of like simplified way then to to get your planning permit. But sometimes you need a complete new, what we call in Australia, development application, and in Germany it's called build permit, and it takes longer. So looking at those things, because those are risks, right? So, so really help like bringing like that vision to life and help managing stakeholders. Because in a theme park, especially in an existing theme park, as you know and you can imagine, that there's so many different stakeholders, and everyone got a different kind of like requirement or has a different expectation of what the project shall do. So I don't know, your operational director or the people like working on the roller coaster would like to improve like your lining up and make that more efficient and you know, make that. Whereas your marketing director may want to make it like just more like an immersive experience, so you can just maybe charge more. And like, so all these different things, like I try to like understand what's important to everyone. And then obviously there's always like someone who's calling the shots, which someone called project sponsor, someone called a project champion. But he just says, okay, this is what we would like to achieve, like at a certain date for a certain budget. And then I start and ask more questions, like what is important. And then, as you say, like in the theme parks, it's difficult because some theme parks, especially theme parks in Europe, I mean, it's a bit easier with theme parks in Europe because like in Germany, they or in Europe, they close during winter times, right? So you've got a month of a few you've got a window of a few months where you can undertake works. But you just got to make sure then you finish at for the opening date and you allow enough time to, you know, do all the testing and the commissioning and the training of staff, etc. Whereas like theme parks here in Australia, they're just like 365 days a year, right? So when you do projects in a live environment, it's a different kind of like ball game, because you just there's school holidays you have to work around, there's events, there's so many different things which may impact what you can and can't do. So it's a tricky work environment in theme parks.
I can imagine. So in this imaginary theme park that we've got, that's got a new attraction, and I don't, is it different depending if you're working for that theme park or if you are just an external consultant? Do you get brought in at a different point? Like if you're working for the company itself, are you there from the very start? Or are the plans kind of late, set out in some form, and they come to you and go, does this work?
It really depends. I mean, some operators in the world, they've got an internal project management department, and they've got an internal project manager who's kind of like overseeing it. And quite often they get external project managers to help and support on certain things, for example. But yeah, it's a different thing. Like it's really like it is different. Like if I'm external, obviously I'm external. I am not the client, so I'm perceived also by other consultants in a very different way. So it's something which you need to be aware of, right? And then sometimes it's hard to manage that, because consultants know that as well and say, well, you're not really the client, you're the client rep, but you're not really the client. So and then go around your back and then talk to the client directly. So it's a tricky environment. But at the end of the day, theme parks, and then I was thinking about it today again, like before our podcast, and thought like what makes a theme park project so different, so special, and how do we who work in that environment like manage those projects? And I think one of the key things is really communication. It's there's so much communication required on such a project just to understand everyone and every requirement. And if we take like a zoo, for example, and you do a project, you do an addition, and as you mentioned, like zoos are changing because they move away from having big animals, which usually draw in a lot of people, to and being like a purely educational kind of like environment, to now becoming more not a theme park, but just become more of an experience, and trying to substitute the loss of like big animals, which I agree is like you shouldn't hold big animals in small enclosures or habitats. So they're changing, but then working in a zoo with animals is just another level up again, because then you need not only have like guests which you need to be aware of and work around, and staff which you have to work around, but you also got animals, and so noisy works become an issue, or works which cause vibration in particular, more so than noisy works. So you cannot like, for example, jackhammer for 8 hours next to a chimpanzee exhibit, right? So you can do it maybe for 2 hours, and you take a break for a day and you do it again. So all these things make it very difficult and different on these projects. But it's coming down to communication. And that's where I think someone like me and my colleagues, where we come in and we ask the right question at the start of the project so that you can make everyone involved aware of it. You can make like your designers aware of that, for example, and you can make your, more importantly, the contractors who are pitching for the project, that you just describe the scope and say, hey, you know, don't expect you can just, you know, jackhammer for 8 hours in a row. You have to do it like over like 5 days, right? So that's where, like, I think project managers like add value, because they just help to ask the right questions.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So when you first get involved, the plans sound like they kind of know what they want, but they're quite vague in that they might say, oh, well, we want it to open next year. And you have to say, okay, well, realistically, you're probably not going to get it until maybe next June rather than maybe next March. Is that the kind of thing that you do? You kind of take the plan and go and then sort of dampen them down a little bit of a wet sponge on it and go, we just need to be realistic, because otherwise it's just not going to happen.
Correct. So what I always do before I talk about budgets and fees and challenges and all of that, I start with the program and work my way backwards and try to understand how realistic is it to achieve next year, for example. But for that, again, I need to understand, like, can I work, for example, during school holidays in a zoo or whatever. So all these questions are asked. So I start with that, and then you also need to think about, like, what we're doing. Is that something which already kind of like exists, or is like, is that an innovation which like requires research and development? So you need to allocate time for that. And then if you work with existing brands, you have to consider the IP mm-hmm. owner approval as well. So there's that going forwards and backwards with the design. So all these kind of things you need to factor in. And again, like some operators have an internal department who can do all of that and is aware of that, but not a lot. Mm-hmm. And again, that's where a project manager comes in and helps just to in the first place to check how realistic is that vision to be realized at a certain point. And then as you say, like, and then gently push back and say, well, it's not possible. But it's not about just saying it's not possible. It's about, okay, what can we achieve? And how important is it, for example, that you open something next year? And then there might be a really important driver, because it's like maybe the 50th anniversary or maybe something very important, right? So, and then say, well, we really have to open something. And then I go deeper into this. Okay, why don't we just consider maybe staging a project and say, okay, we do one part next year and make mm-hmm. it like a big kind of like announcement and an opening, and then the next part follows maybe 6 months later or a year later, which quite often works as well for operators, because they like having something new every year, right? So it drives people in, so it's not a bad thing, but it's really just, and that's again, it's that communication. It's like talking to the client and trying to understand, okay, what is important to you and what is most important.
Yeah, so I guess finding the middle ground, and nobody wants to be the bearer of bad news and say, I know you've got this wonderful idea, but it's just not practical. So it's how you say that in a political way, which doesn't scare
correct.
Them
and also, it also goes against the whole industry if you would just say yes or no, right? Yeah. I laugh working in the industry, because it's such a creative industry, and that innovation, which I mentioned at the start, innovation doesn't happen just with yes or no. And innovation happens if you push the boundaries and you say, okay, next year may not be possible for what we're thinking about right now, but if we change something slightly, like how do we make that work, right? So it's really about like working with the team and as a team. And then that's the other important thing. As a project manager, you kind of hold the strings and guide everyone in the right direction, but it's a team behind and next to you, which kind of like helps making it then become a reality. And it's really just steering, like steering a ship, like a really stupid kind of like, but it's kind of like, it is like that.
Yeah.
You just help guiding them in the right direction. And And yeah, maybe just, yeah, I don't know, I've thought about it, but maybe a bit like a captain. And sometimes, yeah, I think captains have quite a lot of authority on a ship as well, which they need to have. And because sometimes they need to make decisions. I think it's similar to project managers. You sometimes have to say, no, that doesn't work. It just doesn't work. So, and that's sometimes that it is like that. Sometimes it is a no. It's like, because it just doesn't work. But that's the last resort.
Try and find a solution in between first. And once you've got all these people who you're sort of captaining, if we use that analogy, once if the project's kind of underway, if some of them start falling behind, is that your responsibility to try and get them up to speed, or are you just kind of at that point, well, look, I've told them what they need to do. Like, does the buck stop with you there or not?
No, well, I care. So I see if someone is falling behind. There are people who may not like, for them the job is done was just putting the team together and say, okay, we signed all the contracts and I've told them what to do, so I come back in 2 months and check in again. So, but that's more like administering a project rather than managing it. So no, it's really, it doesn't stop there. Like the easy part is really just to get people on board, and getting a consultant team on board is relatively easy because you just, you tender the works and you get everyone as excited working on these projects. So usually you get a lot of interest, right? So you put your team together, you get them on board, but that's when the fun starts, and that's when the work starts as a project manager as well. And you've got your weekly meetings, and you've got a program. You've got a program as much as you've got a program for construction. You've got a program for the design with certain milestones, and for example, budget is always like an important thing, right? So you can't just only look at program. You need to look at budget at the same time. And at the start of the project, you've got a budget, which say like, I don't know, $10 million, but you haven't broken it down, and you don't know how to spend it. And then you start, as you progress with the design, you start, okay, I need 5 million for construction. I need 3 million for the roller coaster. And but you don't know the final cost till it's fully designed. So you need to check in at certain stages, and you need to, I call it like hold points. You just stop the design, and there's certain, like, you finish the concept design, and then you review the cost again. So, oh, are we still on track? Or is something like, because it's far more complex than what we thought, like you need for the roller coaster, it's a very unstable ground, you need much more foundation. Suddenly foundation is a really, really big cost. And that takes away then from the product. And the idea always is in theme parks or attractions, it's like you want to spend as much money as possible at front of house compared to back of house, because that's what people see, right? So, but then suddenly, like, you can't build a roller coaster without the proper foundation. So you must spend that money. So that's why these hold points are important. And then again, you come together as a team and say, okay, what can we do about it? Right? We can't make that problem go away, so we have to deal with it. So, and then you just work with the team, and if you stay close to the design of the team, you realize quite quickly if someone falling behind, and then you can usually like work with them and get them back on track. So, but it requires you to be involved the whole time and stay close to the team to understand what's going on.
I guess some things are like you say, when you can work at parks in Europe over winter, that's a good thing. But also the reason you can work at those parks is because the weather's terrible and that's why they're closed. Will that hinder projects? Is the weather a massive problem?
In Germany, it is like I had a project in at Legoland in Germany, and we were doing two things at the time. We built There is a an underground bowling alley which we added in 2000, I think 10 or 11, and that's just dug into the ground, right? So, and there's a holiday camp expansion as well, like I think it was an Egyptian themed holiday camp expansion. So building that in winter is hard because if the ground is frozen, you can't really dig into it, right? So, or if it's too cold, you can't really do plaster works outside on the holiday camp. And so, yeah, it comes like, yeah, it sounds like it's good to have a break, but you're right, there's a break for a reason, and it's closed for a reason, right? So, because certain things just don't work as well as they do in summer. So, yeah, it's all these things you need to factor in, and again, like, that's where, as an experienced project manager, you come in and you factor in contingencies in your budget, but also in your program. And you just say, okay, we can't assume that the winter will be a mild winter and we can work for 5 months or 4 months. Let's assume we, let's factor in like 2 weeks of stoppage or whatever. So all these things, yeah, play a role, absolutely.
Yeah, I can imagine that it's a tricky thing to try and quantify when you are planning a project over winter. Like, how many days do we need to write off for just terrible weather? But I guess that, like you say, the more you do it, the more you can kind of see the law of averages of how many over a winter period you won't be able to work for, and hope that that works out for
Yeah,
you and isn't.
but it's a very standard thing in Europe. Like allowing for bad weather in programs, it's a very standard thing. It's not common in Australia at all. Like you just don't allow for bad weather,
We don't have that here.
because we don't have bad weather. So usually,
Yeah, you just have massive spiders and snakes who might crawl in and
yeah, correct. So we allow for spiders and snake breaks. So.
I'd love that. I'd love to see that in an official document. What's this cost? Spider removal. You've talked about obviously that the money and the budget, and everything comes down to money at the end of the day, doesn't it? If you do see costs spiraling quite significantly, I guess if you're in this initial scoping out phase and you've done some of your research and you're looking at the foundations, have you ever had a situation where the cost has come back quite significantly more than the original budget was going to be, and have they been able to meet that budget, or has the project had
Yeah,
to change?
absolutely. And so typically what we do, we start a project with a budget, which is based on, because we've got so much experience and a lot of clients got experience. So they give you like kind of like an example project, said, hey, they've done that, or we've done that, like, I don't know, last year or 2 years ago, and then here's a budget and that's what we spent. So that's always a good starting point. But if that's not existing, then we've got enough data that we can start putting a budget together, and then you just put placeholders in, like for a roller coaster or for theming and for design, and there's certain costs which you just know it's about kind of like that, and that's how you start with the budget, and that's why these whole points come in very important, that you just always check against that, and the more detail you have in your design, the more detailed your budget can be, and then we always do a very detailed budget breakdown, because what it does help you with is like it helps you to understand cost better. So I could tender a project and say, build me one roller coaster, including, I don't know, station and back of house areas, et cetera, and give me one cost. And then the contractor will happily do that and come back, well, it's $10 million. But you do not know how that's broken down. So, but if you break it down, if you tender it in this way, and you've got a very detailed, we call it like a returnable pricing schedule, where like, I don't know, electricity and mechanical works and the roller coaster and foundation and everything is itemized. You see where the costs are and where it's very high. So when you then need to make changes and you're over budget, it helps you with value engineering. Or let's, for example, theming. Theming is always like it can be very costly. But you can be smart about it, and you can substitute, let's take rock work, for example, which is a lot used in sea life and aquariums, like internally. And it's always nice if you can do like everything in rock work. It looks great. But in reality as well is that rock work costs anything in Australia between, depending on the quantity, how much you buy, but between like $1,000 and $1,500 a square meter. So that adds up quite a lot. So, but when you're smart about it, then you can say, well, why don't we substitute some of the rock work with wall graphics, which these days you can print them so photorealistic, and put them in areas which are not so accessible to guests, and focus on like make those things which guests can access and touch and feel, make those real rock work, and those which are further away, higher up, use different material and make it like different. So that's how you start, and then you just start. Okay, we can save costs. We can use for the floor, a different floor. It doesn't need to be, I don't know, no one puts it in, but just as an example, like Italian marble. Use a local stone, which is like, it's also like high quality, got the similar strengths. It looks different, but substituting things. So that's what you do, and you cut scope as well. But the cutting scope is always kind of like the last resort. We always try to find a way to realize everything which we had in our vision and in the project brief, which is what we start with every project, like what we've described. We try to achieve all of that. But yeah, cost is always an issue, and I never, I don't think I ever had a project which came in when we tendered it and priced it, which was like, oh, this is so much under budget, easy going, right? Excuse me. It's always a challenge, but it's always possible. And again, it's coming down to communication. It's coming down to your team. And I can talk about a very funny example. And I don't think Merlin will mind if I talk about that. So
If you
we
mind,
did.
Merlin, just avert your ears for the next couple of
It's
minutes.
no, it's actually a funny example. It taught me a lot, and it changed the way Merlin does projects. And I have to say, Merlin do projects in a great way. And I learned a lot from Merlin. And so when we did after Sea Live Munich, we did Sea Live Hanover in Germany, which was a refurbishment of an existing kind of like rainforest glass dome, and we put an aquarium in there. And the theming booklet showed I think it was a Mayan temple or something. That was a huge Mayan temple in the middle of the dome. And around was like a very lush kind of like green and lots of tanks and all of that. So, and all this green and tanks and everything was in there. But because we had a budget problem, we kind of like value engineered, and by value engineering, we took that temple out. But what happened back in the day is like Merlin didn't have those procedures and policies in place where significant changes need to be signed off by the top tier management level, right? So it was kind of like decided on a lower level, but I think there was a breakdown in communication, wasn't really properly communicated. So anyway, I remember vividly when Nick Varney back in the day came to the just before the opening, and we walked the side and we showed him around, and he had the theming booklet in his hand. And he stopped in this glass dome, and there was this kind of like viewing platform as well in there. And he stopped there, and we stood there, and he said, "Well, look, that looks great." And they said, "Well, where's my temple?" We said, "Well, did no one tell you? Like, what that temple? That we won't get that temple. We couldn't afford it." And so it was still a great attraction, and you know, it was a bad thing, but it was a good kind of like lesson learned. And Merlin changed then, and significant changes then had to be signed off by the relevant stakeholders. And that's the important thing, is like you can do a lot to bring a project back on budget and back on time as well, but it needs to be communicated with everyone, and
Yeah.
you need to make sure you don't compromise on certain things. You need to make sure that you don't go too nuts with your value engineering, so the product suffers so much that it's not a big bang when you open and people come
Yeah.
in and say, "Well, what is that?"
Yeah.
You can't compromise on work health safety. You can't compromise too much on the guest experience. When you work with animals, you can't compromise on animal welfare at all, right?
Yeah,
So
absolutely.
it's just there's certain things you can't do, and a lot of things you can do, but it comes down to talking to everyone and get everyone on board and having it. And that's, again, like me as a project manager, that's kind of like the probably to you and the likes, like the boring part of the job, but then making sure that those changes are signed off. Like, you know, it's not about just talking to someone, "Hey, we changed that. Yeah, are you okay?" It's about like I would then summarize it and send it to relevant stakeholders, said, "Hey, please sign off," or I send a memo or a minute or something like that. It's just like everyone is aware of that.
I mean, it sounds like Nick took his removal of his temple quite well, but I guess he might not have. He might have demanded at that point that he got put back in, and then everyone's got an issue. So yeah, that it makes perfect sense. And also, I suppose it's understanding the creative department's vision and making sure that you don't take something that's really integral to their storytelling side of it. Because if they'd built a whole piece of artwork around this temple or a whole story or something like that, and then it was expected to be there, then the removal of that would then compromise all of those things as well. So like you say, yeah, speaking to everyone and making sure everyone's informed, and that if you change something, it's not going to have a knock-on effect onto something else that.
Correct. And Merlin is a good example again, like that has changed. They've evolved so much from where we were 20 years ago to where Merlin is now, with a lot of really highly qualified, great creative internal resources and people. And it's not just the creative department, but then you've got brand and marketing, and There's so much more going into everything Merlin does these days, and a sea life is not just about like showing fish anymore. It's about conservation. It's about education. There's far more going in, and again, like it's yeah, you just got to make sure you get everyone on board and everyone agreed to, and I think that is all. It's also kind of like the secret behind Merlin's success is that they've got so many talented people who just like work together and then come up with kind of like the best solutions for what they want or the best way to do things. What they call the Merlin magic making. It's just like it's funny. Like we used to be when I was with Merlin, I think it was called PDG, Project Development Group. I think that's what our department was called, and then it changed to Merlin magic making, and me being German and being like an architect, like when I suddenly like I got told like work for the Merlin magic making department, I was like, well, that sounds a bit weird. And I remember my German colleagues, we were all like, oh, that's a bit of a interesting name, and we haven't been asked, and what, but why would we have been asked? But like in hindsight now, like it makes so much sense, because it's really like it's just like with that Merlin magic making, it just delivers that kind of like what they're trying to achieve, and they do achieve it. It's just it's a great thing. So
It's kind of taken a leaf out of the Disney book, that, isn't it? The Merlin magic making. Although I love that you did actually live up to the German stereotype there.
well, sometimes I do. Sometimes, it's funny. Sometimes it helps me as a project manager. And then I must say, like when I started with Merlin, like that was the first time I worked with English people. And English, you guys are so polite, and you're
Oh,
so
are we?
much, yes, and you're so much like not that black and white, and you're really good in sugarcoating things, and here came me, like a young Benedict, and coming from a builder, from a construction site, where I was dealing with like rough contractors, and kind of like I had a very steep learning curve working with English people, but I think I found a good balance now. And then moving to Australia, I think that was the next level. It's like, because they take it a step further with sugarcoating things and being laid back and still expecting the same outcome, right? So they're just like they smile at you, and when they deliver the bad news. But it's I think it's good to have a bit of that German kind of like background, and sometimes being not really that black and white, but like I think I found a good compromise now. Most times, there's probably some clients who may listen and say, "Well, we disagree, Benedict." I think overall, like I've changed a lot and found a good compromise now.
Adapted to your audience.
I have.
We need a bit of that German straight talking though sometimes. And before we start recording, we chatted a bit about Europa Park and how that park just operates very, very efficiently. And I'm sure that is the German way. And I think that park couldn't operate like that anywhere else in the world because you need the Germans who are just like, no, it's going to get done and it will get done like this.
It's no, and you're right, and it kind of like it helps in Australia sometimes to open doors, when especially with my engineering background, and people have a very high regard German engineering very high in Australia, and it just helps, right? So and I think yes, we are quite efficient quite often, and so it certainly helps. But a bit funny thing, nothing to do with, or maybe it has to do with theme parks as well. It's something which like blew me away when I moved to Australia. It's like people in Australia, they line up for the bus. There's a line. Whoever comes first stands first, and people line up behind. You do not see that in Germany. The bus arrives and everyone just runs into the bus. Not
Really?
as badly as like a Travel India, and there where people like they jump into the bus while it's still driving, and into the train and out of the train. So it's not as that, but it's really like when I came here, and then people were like over like 100 meters around the corner, and I was like, what is that? And then you realize, well, they're lining up for the bus. So it's funny. So Australians are quite in some ways quite organized as well. And I
That's the
think you do
British
that in England as
influence.
well, don't you? Yeah, you do that
Yeah,
as
we
well, I
love a
think, in England,
queue.
right? So,
Oh, we'll start a queue for nothing. If the person is stood still, we will assume it's a queue and we will start to form behind them.
Well, there's signs in Australia. There's a few pubs I've been to because it's in, and I read about it recently. There's signs in pubs which tell you to not line up at the
At the
bar.
bar,
And because the bar is kind of like 10 meters wide, and then they say, no, you just approach the bar. When there's a free spot, you just approach the bar. You do not line up. So, and it requires signs now in Australia to tell people not to line up. And
That's ha
so it,
happened here. Which I don't know, because we love a queue in the UK, but the pub has always been the free for all. That is like our little slice of just go
breaking
for
out of
it.
your
Yeah,
breaking out of your
exactly.
habit
It's
and
that one
go loose,
place.
letting your hair down
Yeah, just
and
go
jump the
crazy.
queue.
As soon as you've walked in a pub, you go where you want. But more recently, people have started queuing. I think like younger generations are like, oh no, we must queue. And my
It's younger,
husband gets so annoyed. He's like, we don't do that at the pub. We don't queue.
but then you feel bad when you approach a bar, you kind of like feel bad. But only for a second, then you get your pint, and you're like, "Oh, that's fine." So it's kind of, but it's a funny thing. It's an interesting thing.
I'm amazed that Germans don't queue though. I've never like I haven't spent a
No,
huge amount of time in Germany, and I would have assumed that you absolutely love the order of a queue. So yeah, that's interesting.
we don't.
Fascinating. I follow a guy on TikTok called Yannick, who's a German, and he does a lot of sort of stereotypical German stuff in a very light-hearted, funny way. And the thing that surprised me that he always does is that Germans like to have like printouts of stuff. It's like you don't trust it to just remain on your screen. You have to have it physically printed. Is that does
Oh
that come into your work
yeah.
as well with you? Do you have a big project management folder where
I do, but so yes. So I just came back from Melbourne today. So, and I don't know, it's a bit blurry now, but so I've got this kind of like I
Oh,
printed
it's
all
all
the
not
plans.
yeah.
I've printed all the plans out and I take them to site. So I've got my little, but again, like it's like I just on your phone you can't really see it. And then again, with my engineering background, I just need drawings and I use it to you see a bit of markup. So I use it to sketch on it and to demonstrate things and what I think. So we do love our printouts, but I think I saw something similar. Like there was something on Instagram where they were filming in a German kind of like train, and everyone had printed out their ticket,
I
which
think
is a
he's the same guy,
yeah, digital ticket, but it's all printed out. So but I'm the same. I would print it out just to be safe, right? Because you could run out of power. Like
Well, yeah, you
what happens?
could.
Or there's a malfunction with your phone. Like I didn't have one in 20 years, but it could happen, right? So, but again, I think that's maybe why I kind of became a project manager. I'm just prepared for kind of like everything. So, and I always got a plan B to make to work around that. But yeah, no, it's a funny thing.
I have to ask, having just come back from Europa Park as well, what is the German obsession with sparkling water?
It's just great. I don't know why not the whole world would bring sparkling water. And it's I'm very surprised that it's not a big thing, and it's not a big thing in Australia either. And I don't know if you've heard of Apfelschorle. It's apple juice, and I like we drink it in Australia. Like my kids drink it all the time, but I don't know why no one made a big business out of it. It's just apple juice with sparkling water
Sparkling
mixed with
water,
sparkling water, and it's such a refreshing thing.
I
It's
will give
just a
you
great thing.
that. Yeah, I will give you
I
that.
just, I don't understand why the rest of the world doesn't drink it. So the question is not like what's our obsession with it. I think the right question is like why hasn't the rest of the world adapted to it?
The apple shawl I'll give you because it basically makes apple juice a lot less sickly, and that's quite r nice and refreshing, especially on a hot day in a theme park. But the sparkling water thing, though, it just tastes like drinking
No.
Velcro. It's
No. I just, I mean, it depends. Like, I just like a medium kind of like sparkling. And in Germany,
This
we've
is
got low sparkling, medium,
it.
and the proper sparkling. That's a tough one. That's for tough guys, right? So I can't drink that. So it's the medium. It's the medium sparkling.
Honestly, I went to Lidl in Rust, and I've never I spent a good 10 minutes looking at the water selection, trying to work out which one wasn't sparkling. I thought I'd made the correct choice when I went with natural, because obviously water isn't naturally sparkling. Got it home. No, that is sparkling as well.
Well, I'll tell you a trick. The trick is because these days all plastic bottles. If you just press the bottle a little bit, you can feel like if it's not hard, obviously, then it's still water. But if it's just like hot, then it's sparkling. So it's
Okay.
yeah. So,
Well,
but
I'll use
yeah.
that on my next trip. And the lack of tap water available. If you've ever been to a theme park
Oh.
in Germany, you cannot get your water bottle filled. They look at you. If you ask for tap water,
Yeah.
oh.
It's weird. No, I agree. It's weird. Like there's tap water everywhere in Australia and it's free.
Yeah.
So
And then German
everywhere.
water, I'm sure, is very clean and pure. So yeah, funny. Well, that's been an enjoyable little side dive into the differences between them. But as you say, it's what you learn when you work with different cultures and you work in different countries. Everyone has their own little quirks and things like this. And it's if you can bring those people together under the banner of sparkling or non-sparkling water, then you can find some middle
I think,
ground somewhere.
yeah, no, I think you're right, and I think that's the other thing. Like it's what I love about the theme park industry, but what also like is another complexity is like because there's so many people who are specialized in what they're doing, and they're usually based in different countries, America and Europe and whatever, and you bring that team together, and managing a team of different cultures and different nationalities, like that's just like a challenge in itself, and not let alone like different time zones, and just making
Yeah.
sure meetings are kind of like work for everyone, and it's a challenge, but also like something I really enjoy. And as you say, like having this chat and learn about other cultures and what's important to them and what's special about them, it's just like it's an enjoyable part of I think what I do, and that's I think reason why I do what I do.
And the
And not have
attractions
that.
industry is so global at the moment. I mean,
Oh.
you'll go everywhere. You'll all go everywhere. Like, obviously, you're in Australia. You have Australians here. America, like the Middle East, is huge. There's so
Oh,
much
it's huge.
going on there. And obviously, they're drawing on experience from people like you who've worked all over the world as well to come and bring your experience to the projects that they're building there. Yeah, it must be a really fascinating industry to work in at the moment. And like we said at the start, really, really exciting to have so many options for you.
Yeah, it's a great time. Middle East is it's tough because they would like that they want to employ you and not like engage you as a
Yeah.
consultant necessarily. That they prefer that. But Middle East that they're going nuts at the moment. It's just
Yeah.
crazy, crazy,
Yeah.
crazy what's happening
I'm
there.
moving
It's
out there
just
in 4 weeks, and yeah,
oh.
it's definitely an ex a very exciting place to be as an attraction
Oh,
fan.
absolutely, absolutely.
As we wrap this up, we've talked about the challenge that you have with these projects from the start, and how you manage budgets and the people and weather. Once you get to the end of all of that, you're at the finishing line, or the finishing line is in sight. How does that feel as a project manager? Are you still on edge until it's actually open, or when can you see the
Yeah.
finishing line and you're like, okay, I can start to relax now?
Usually not. Like I hardly had any projects where you've got so much time left over that you just like you're just cruising to the end. Like it just usually doesn't happen because you just like unexpected things happen. And the other important thing is like once you've finished, you kind of like it's a long handover phase, and there's a lot of like then the contractors will like a roller coaster contractor will kind of like start commissioning the roller coaster, and then the testing starts, and then the external experts come in and test and sign off the ride, for example, and then the training starts, right? And then you need to allow enough time to train your staff and your team. And when it comes to working in zoos, like I've been involved in at Taronga Zoo, they're replacing. They've got a cable car going up and down the hill, and we've been engaged to help them to replace that. We're initially thinking about making it much bigger and kind of like spanning across the entire zoo, but it just became a very complex and very very costly project, so it's been scaled back. But when we discussed, and that's something I learned again, like at that project, when we discussed the training commissioning, it was like, we allow like 3 months to slowly start commissioning the system, and that doesn't include the testing because you can't just turn on a cable car next to an animal exhibit. You just like you need to slowly get animals accustomed to that new thing, so you just do it very slowly, and you may only run like one cable car an hour for like 4 hours. So just slowly start. So, but those kind of things you need to consider. So there's a lot at the end to just make sure that when you open, that you open A with your best product, but it's also like a very, very, very safe environment for your guests, right? So, and your team feels really comfortable in operating the new attraction and understand, like, even if it's not a roller coaster and it's just like it's an immersive audio visual kind of like video experience, like, but that they know how to if there's an issue, how to reset it and all these kind of things, right? So there's a lot going in. So it's kind of like there's never a phase in the project where it's easy cruising. It's really, I would say it's at the start is where when you start writing the project brief and work with the stakeholders, that's probably the phase where it's kind of like not the easiest, but the calmest kind of like phase where you've got a bit of time. But after that, like it ramps up and it stays at that level the whole time. And but then it drops like at the end, like there's a day and you open and you see guests coming in enjoying it. And usually, and that's the other thing, you usually get to enjoy things before guests come in and you do a contractor event and family and friend event, etc. You bring your own family and you bring your friends and contractors, and you've got a big kind of opening thing. You test it yourself, you've got a big party, you have a few beers. Like it's a great, great feeling, right? So it's really like you know, it's you're working on adrenaline the whole time and on a very high pace, but then it drops off in a good way at the end, and then you just get to enjoy it, right? And you're just like, wow, this is just amazing. So that's the other thing, like you just, and then you get to come back a year later or 2 years later, 3 years later. Like I've been in Munich 2 years ago and I've been to SILAV Munich, and you know, I've built that thing 15, 20 or 20 years ago now. So it's coming back and seeing it still being in place. It's just great, right? Things evolved and have changed, but it's just like it's still what you've built, right? It's great. I love it.
It must be an amazing feeling to have. We've talked to John Maudley on the podcast, who's obviously notorious roller coaster designer, and he's talked about the feeling that you get when you see people enjoying what you've built or designed from the ground up for the first time. And that must make all of the late nights and the sleepless nights when things have been going wrong worth it. And I guess you always have a feeling of it'll come together in the end somehow. We will always get there. But I can imagine it's stressful at points getting there. But then when you see everyone enjoying it, it's all been worth it.
You have to have that feeling, and you have to, and that's the other thing, you have to. With your team as a project manager, you need to have this optimism and say, no, it will work out. Trust me. Like, we will make it happen. Trust me. If you start like questioning yourself or your team, then the whole team will start questioning things, and the client will get nervous. And like, I always like, I raise, if I see big problems or like a serious problem, I will raise it with the client. I never hide things, but I come with a solution as well. And I always like, we will make it work. We will make it happen. And you have to. If you don't do that, it's just like you can't work on these projects. It just doesn't work.
And I guess as soon as one's opened, you're then on to the next one, and you have a day of like, oh, I enjoy this. Right now, what's next? The turntable doesn't stop for you.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Benedict, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you and finding out a bit more about what goes on behind the scenes when we come to enjoy these things. We know that they don't all just fly up overnight. We know that there's a lot of hard work, but I think sometimes we don't necessarily appreciate everything that goes into it and how these things happen. Right, before you go though, I have just got one more question for you.
Just gotta ride it.
This is Just Gotta Ride It. You know this if you're a regular listener to the podcast. When we have a guest on, we always ask them which roller coaster in the world they would save if they could only save one, which is the one that we've all got to make sure that we've gone and ridden. Benedict, you've mentioned you're not a huge fan of spin and spews, as we might call them, some of the flat rides, but roller coasters you're all right with. So which one would you give us?
What springs to mind is Colossus in Heide Park. I just like timber kind
Okay.
of like roller coaster. So that is one which I really enjoyed. And it's because all the squeaking and noises and the speed is and the thought about like, oh, this could go wrong, it's just great. And similar, I've been to Kolmården,
Yeah.
Kolmården, I think the Swedes call it, during working on that cable car project. And we just, because they've got a really great cable car, but they also got a fantastic roller coaster. The names escape me, but I think it's like the second fastest or something in the world, or used to be. And that's a timber one as well. And those two, I would say, like are really kind of like ones which I enjoyed, but at the same time hated. But I think that's what you want to achieve with roller coasters. You want to have this
Yeah.
hate love kind of relationship, right? So,
Yeah, for a lot of the people. Yeah, it's Wildfire, the coaster that you're talking about. And interestingly, Mark, when he was on the podcast, Mark Schurer, I know, like we mentioned that you know, he chose that one as well. So yeah, and I think it's interesting what they've done there because it is essentially a zoo, and then they've put in this huge, very critically acclaimed roller coaster there, and they've done that diversification, and it's worked really well, and it shows that the two things can go hand in hand together.
It's interesting because we went through the park with the team, and there's when you're on the roller coaster, you see like there's a little kind of like holiday house nearby, and that's where the owners have their kind of like holiday house, and they're so much into that roller coaster and that whole park, and they just build it there, and that's what the team told us to so they can watch people go on the roller coaster. They're so fascinated with the roller coaster that they can sit on the terrace, have a beer, barbecue, and just watch the roller coaster. It's great.
Wow. That's the
It's
kind of
yeah,
thing
it's
we
ma
do as roller coaster nerds do
it's
that.
it's amazing. It's nice. So yeah, those two are great. And then but I'm also a traditionalist. Like I like a wild mouse. Like a wild mouse anywhere in the world, they always like they're great fun. I love it.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I only, usually only allow one, but
Okay, then take Colossus. Colossus is the one which I
there you go. The German makes the decision. If that's the rules, it's one. It's Colossus. It's a good choice. No one's chosen that one before, actually. So yeah, you can have that one. I'll put your name next to that one. Benedict, thanks so much for joining us on Parkcast. As we said, you've got your own consulting company now, VSK Projects. I know you're on LinkedIn a lot. You don't really do like the rest of the social media. You're not on TikTok doing dancing and stuff
I
like
don't have TikTok now. I
that.
started doing Instagram, but I'm not good with my BSK profile on Instagram, but I will get better.
Yeah, well, you exist, and you're doing some fantastic work and some really exciting work. And I really appreciate you taking some time out of your very busy day to chat to us today. If you have enjoyed today's episode, please do give us a little rating and let us know what you thought. Leave us a review or drop me a comment in my DMs. And if you haven't already, if you subscribe, you're going to get a notification whenever we release a new episode, so you'll never miss one. For now, though, we've been Parkcast.
Parkcast. The UK's original theme park podcast.